And what I'm going to talk about today is how do you reconcile the early chapters of Genesis with the latest scientific findings. And you can contact us on a variety of social media. Reasons to Believe actually has a 24/7 YouTube channel. And incidentally, what's happening here today is going up on YouTube. And so if you missed the previous talks, you can get them on YouTube. You can, of course, get them at paradoxes.org. And you can text me at 31996, and that's your portal to get lots of free videos, book chapters, articles, and much more. We're going to dedicate most of the time today to Q&A, but if you don't get to ask your question, I do answer questions on both my Facebook and Twitter page. And sometimes it's just fun to see what kind of questions people are posing there, so feel free to eavesdrop if you so choose. And some of the free book chapters we're giving away is one from this book, The Creator and the Cosmos, which was the theme of last week's talk. You can get a free chapter by going to reasons.org/Ross. And the theme today, Navigating Genesis, we're giving away a free chapter of that book and also of my latest book, Always Be Ready. But what we're going to look at is how can we test Genesis with advancing science? And I got a question for all of you. How many have ever run into someone who says, I can't believe the Bible because science contradicts or refutes Genesis? And have you ever had that happen to you? I actually have it happen to me in public debates. In fact, not too far away from here is the headquarters of the Skeptic Society, and I've debated the executive director there, Michael Shermer, 4 times on university campuses. And usually the theme is something like, does science reveal God? But no matter what the topic, when Michael gets his turn to speak, he goes straight after Genesis 1 every single time. And he's not the only one. I've also seen that with other scientists I've debated, especially those in Europe. And they view Genesis as the Achilles heel of the Christian faith, that they can destroy a Christian's faith in God and the Bible simply by going after the early chapters of Genesis. And this has had an impact on Christian scholars, both theologians and scientists. In fact, when I speak on seminary campuses, conservative seminary campuses, what I'm finding is a growing movement of theologians basically looking at Genesis and saying, we have to reinterpret Genesis. We can't stick with historical view of Genesis. So for example, in a book recently written by Dennis Alexander, he writes this, quote, those who maintain the historical view of Genesis 1 are embarrassing and bring the gospel into disrepute. And that's something I'm finding on seminary campuses is this idea. We have to stop trying to defend the historicity of Genesis because they view it's impossible to reconcile an historical interpretation of Genesis with the scientific record. But here's the problem. Take those early chapters of Genesis, especially Genesis 1, put them in front of somebody who's never been exposed to the Bible and ask them, what is this all about? And what they discover is it reads exactly like an historical account. In fact, I would argue that when you look at Genesis 1, the author is making great pains to establish that this is an account of real history. After all, it's set up as a chronology. You've got these numbered days, and they're sequential. You've got the phrase repeated, and it was so, and it was so. And also the repetition, it was good, it was good. And so by 3 different tools, you've got Moses here communicating this really is an historical account of actual events. Now, where do these theologians and people like Dennis Alexander go wrong? In my opinion, they go wrong by their failure to follow the biblical testing method and to integrate all of Bible's creation texts. Genesis 1 is not the only text in the Bible that takes you through the content of the 6 days. It's not even the most extensive text. Job 37, 38, and 39 give you far more detail on the science that's going on and the history that's going on in the creation than what you get in Genesis chapter 1. Psalm 104 is another example, as is Proverbs 8. And so that's what we're going to kind of do this morning, is kind of show you how to integrate these creation texts. And if you go to reasons.org, we actually give you a list of 27 major creation texts in the Bible. It's not just the four that I've been talking to you about. But yeah, the big problem is that these theologians and scientists are failing to follow the biblical testing method, which is also known as a scientific method. You know, when I speak in front of university audiences, they're quite stunned when I make the claim, guess where the scientific method came from? It came from these biblical texts on creation. It's no accident that the scientific revolution exploded out of Reformation Europe. What was happening at that time, it wasn't just priests, but people. Ordinary people were reading the Bible for themselves, and those who had a scientific bent not only saw this biblical command to put everything to the test, but how the Bible gives us specific instructions, step by step, how to put everything to the test. And so if you want an outline, we're going to first look at the application of this biblical testing method, particularly step one of the method, do not interpret until you establish the point of view or the frame of reference. We're going to look at the meaning of the word day, and last of all, what we're going to spend most of our time is looking at the description and the order of events in light of the advancing science of the past 70 years. And here's the point. What we see in Psalms and Job, the more we learn about nature, the more evidence we'll uncover for the supernatural handiwork of God. There's another application there. The more we learn about nature, the more evidence we're going to find for the scientific and historical accuracy of everything that the Bible declares. So, first point. A lot of what scientists and theologians fail to recognize is that there's a change in the point of view when you go from Genesis 1:1 to Genesis 1:2. Genesis 1:1, as I mentioned last week, no matter where I go in the world, everybody seems to know at least one Bible verse. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the phrase, the heavens and the earth, refers to the totality of physical reality. And so the frame of reference for Genesis 1:1 is the universe. But the frame of reference for Genesis 1:2 changes from the universe to the surface of the waters of planet Earth. Genesis 1:2, the Spirit of God was hovering where? Over the surface of the waters of the earth. Now, if you keep the point of view up in the universe, then these atheists have got a point. Everything Genesis 1 teaches about science is wrong. Literally everything. But if you put the point of view on the surface of the earth, where the text puts it, then suddenly everything is in the correct order, correctly described in the correct order, as we will see. And so if you remember nothing else from what you hear this morning, remember this. The frame of reference, the point of view for the six creation days is an observer on the surface of the waters. Now, step two of the biblical testing method, don't interpret until you also establish the starting conditions or the initial conditions. And notice that Genesis 1:2 declares these. The Spirit of God is hovering over the surface of the waters. And what does it tell us? Water is everywhere on the surface of the earth. And it's dark on the surface of the waters. And it's empty of life and unfit for life. And now God begins to work. Obvious question. Why is it dark on the surface of the waters? If God created the universe in the beginning, there would be light throughout the universe. But it tells us it's dark on the surface of the waters. Well, remember earlier I mentioned you actually get a more extensive account of the scientific details in Job 37, 38, and 39. This is what Job 38:9 says, where God speaks, and he says, I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness, it referring to the seas that cover the surface of the earth. So notice here it's explicit about why it's dark. It's dark because the clouds would not let light pass through. Now, I must confess I had an advantage when I first picked up the Bible at age 17. I've been studying astronomy seriously since I was 7. And I knew if you got a planet the size of the Earth, the appropriate distance that the Earth is from the Sun, it's going to have an atmosphere about 200 times thicker than what Earth has today. that atmosphere would be so thick it won't let any light pass through. If you want an analogy, think of Venus. Venus is an atmosphere, it's about 80 times thicker than Earth's atmosphere today, and the only light that makes it through the surface is light at the extreme red end of the spectrum. All the rest of the light is blocked out. If you make the atmosphere 200 times thicker, no visible light gets through at all. It's totally dark on the surface of the waters, in spite of the existence of galaxies, stars, and the sun beyond. So, Job 38 is explicit on why it's dark. Now, what about this word day? Now, when I first picked up the Bible at age 17, I recognized that the word day, at a minimum, must have three distinct literal definitions, because three are used in the text. Creation day one, it's contrasting days and nights. That's day referring to the daylight hours. Creation day four, it's contrasting seasons, days, and years. So that's day is 24 hours. But Genesis 2:4, at least in the King James, which is what I was reading at age 17, it uses the word day to refer to the entirety of creation history. That's day as a long period of time. And what I notice is these creation days are bracketed by an evening and a morning. And again, I wasn't sure what the original Hebrew meant about the meaning of the word evening and morning, but it said at a minimum, it's referring to the fact that each of these creation days has a definite start point and a definite end point. But when you get to day seven, there's no evening and morning. And it says, okay, does that mean that we're still in the seventh day? And actually, there are three biblical texts outside of Genesis. And again, if you want to resolve these creation controversies, you have to look at more than just one text. And what you discover is that Psalm 95, John 5, and Hebrews 4 tell us we're still in God's seventh day. For 6 days God creates, on the seventh day he rests. In fact, if you look up a lexicon, which is basically a Hebrew-English dictionary, what you'll discover is that the word yom, translated day, has four distinct literal definitions. It can mean part of the daylight hours, like from noon to 3 p.m., all of the daylight hours, one calendar day, or a long but finite period of time. And as I mentioned, there are three biblical texts that tell us we're still in God's seventh day. Now, I remember at age 17 realizing this solves the fossil record enigma. And, when I was 11, my parents bought me this big, thick book on evolutionary biology, trying to get me to read something besides astronomy and physics. And I remember going to them and saying, "Mom, Dad, the numbers don't add up. We got all this speciation before humanity, and there's hardly any afterwards. How do you explain this?" They said, "Go ask your science teachers." I asked my science teachers, and they said, "Well, go talk to those university professors, you know." They didn't have any idea. But when I first picked up the Bible at age 17, there it is. For 6 days God creates, on the seventh day he stops. That explains a fossil record enigma. The reason we see so much speciation before humanity, those are the days when God's creating new species of life. The reason we don't see hardly any today is God's resting from his work of speciation. Any speciation we see today is what we would call natural speciation. Some of that does happen, but is at a very limited level. Now, if you want to read more about the subject of the creation days, I've actually written an entire book on this, A Matter of Days, of basically making the point that the way to resolve the issue of these days is you have to read the entire Bible, not just one or two books or one or two chapters, but the entire Bible, and read it literally and consistently through all 66 books. That's kind of what I do in A Matter of Days, is take you through the sweep of the entire 66 books and see what it's got to say about these days of creation. But the bottom line is, there is no contradiction between the time scale the Bible communicates about creation and the time scale that we see communicated in the record of nature. Matter of fact, the first time I ever ran into someone who believed that God did it all in six 24-hour days and was talking about the universe being young, I remember sharing with him out of my naivete as an astronomer, well, yeah, I'm a young universe astronomer. Because I was doing that out of the context of a debate that was taking place in the first half of the 20th century, where he had one group of astronomers saying the universe must be at least a quadrillion years old. Another group was saying, no, looks like the Big Bang theory is right and it's only billions of years old. And this 50-year-long debate took place between old universe astronomers and young universe astronomers, and the young universe astronomers won out. By the second half of the 20th century, there was overwhelming evidence that the universe indeed is young. It's only billions of years old. But what I was sharing with these people who were telling me that they thought the Bible is communicating thousands, I said, now let me give you the context for this. The reason why these astronomers were pushing for trillions or quadrillions of years, they knew that billions was way too short a period of time to support a naturalistic interpretation of the origin and history of life. And so they were pushing for the trillions and the quadrillions basically to save the Darwinian paradigm. But the evidence is clear. It's only billions. And if that causes a problem for naturalistic evolutionary theories, then so be it. Well, I want to spend the rest of my time actually taking you through these days of creation and basically show you how indeed advancing scientific discovery gives us a progressively more compelling case that what we see here in the first page of the Bible is scientifically accurate, both in terms of the order of events and the description of the events. And creation day one, let there be light. And this is a reference scientifically to our atmosphere being thinned out from being 200 times thicker than what it is. Indeed, the primordial Earth had an atmosphere that thick. But if it doesn't rain tonight, you'll probably be able to see the moon. And it's thanks to the moon-forming event that our atmosphere got trimmed down to 0.5% of what it was in the beginning. And this is critical for advanced life to exist on the planet. You need a big terrestrial planet. Notice that Earth is the largest of the terrestrial planets in the solar system with a thin atmosphere if you want life. But the principle is the bigger the terrestrial body, the thicker the atmosphere. And thanks to the moon-forming event, we got a big terrestrial planet with a thin atmosphere and we can actually breathe. You know, if you make the atmosphere three times heavier or thicker than what it is today, your lungs stop operating and you die. And it works the other way around too. Make it three times thinner or three times thicker, lungs stop operating. And you need lungs to have advanced animals on the face of the earth. Well, creation day two is the most brief of all the creation days. And this has caused some controversy because of its brevity. All it says is let there be water above and water below. And so there have been theologians who've been speculating all kinds of ideas about what's going on in creation day two. No need to speculate, because if you go to Job 37 and 38, instead of a single short sentence on creation day two, you got an entire chapter and a half. And what it tells us in Job 37 and 38 is how God is setting up this complex water cycle with multiple forms of frozen precipitation and multiple forms of liquid precipitation. And we're just talking about here before we got started about how we're having rain here. And because we got high mountains here in California, we get a lot of snow. Snow melts slowly, and so it gives us a steady supply of water when it's not raining. And this is the principle you see in Job 37 and 38, how God has blessed us with a water cycle with these multiple forms of frozen precipitation. And notice the frozen precipitation it talks about, snow, frost, and hail, you can get these at all latitudes, including the tropics. So literally, we can have humans inhabiting the entire planet. Now, if you want to see in detail the miracles that brought about light coming through to the surface of the waters and allowing photosynthesis to begin, and this amazingly fine-tuned water cycle, we talk about it in our television documentary, Journey Toward Creation. And the one I got up here, it's actually available in 11 different languages. I think we have it over there at the table. And so if you know someone who doesn't know English, you can give them this. As a matter of fact, it's been seen by many more people in Spanish than in English. Journey toward creation. Creation day 3, it says, let dry ground appear. And this is a reference to the transformation of the planet from a water world, where there's no land on the surface at all, to where we have coexisting continents, islands, and oceans. Now, I was reading this for the first time in the 1950s, and that's when the textbooks were saying that the continents have always been here in relatively the same form we see them today. But I remember as a teenager reading those textbooks and recognizing, well, they really aren't giving any evidence for the longevity of the continents. This is simply an assumption they're making. And then when I enrolled at the University of British Columbia, I had an opportunity to take a course in geophysics from two of the three physicists that launched the modern discipline of plate tectonics. In fact, this is the first course that I ever taught on plate tectonics. So I managed to enroll myself in that class with a bunch of other students. I think I was the youngest one in the class there. But the two professors there said, we have a new idea on the continents. It's not that they've always been here in the same form, but this plate tectonics that we discovered actually would give us this kind of a model, where we would see the continents gradually covering more and more the surface of the Earth. And I was not yet a believer. I was reading the Bible this time, but I was not yet a committed Christian. But I remember going up and asking them, okay, is it possible that you actually start at zero on this curve rather than at the 5 to 10% level like you're suggesting in the class? And they said, well, that's possible. We're just guessing that it starts off at 5 to 10%. What we do know is that the continents cover more and more of the surface of the Earth with respect to time. So they said, yeah, it's possible, it's zero. So I'm wondering how this is going to play out as this new discipline of plate tectonics begins to mature. And what happened in the year 2000 is several papers were published basically giving us this picture of the growth of the continental land masses, where we see that indeed Earth starts off as a water world. You get a few small volcanic islands, then the plate tectonics begins to kick in. But what I want you to notice is that period of time when you get the most aggressive growth of the continental land masses, it's when the Earth is a little bit less than half of its current age. Where does Genesis 1 put it? The beginning of creation day 3, a little bit less than half the way through the 6 days of creation. Now, there is another big change in our understanding of the growth of the plate tectonics, similar to this, but with more detail, in a paper that was published this past March, 2018 in March, and basically was making the point that what really stimulates the growth of the continental land masses is oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere. And so they noted that you've got this great oxygenation event that happened beginning 2.45 billion years ago. And so what they published in their paper is the most detailed and accurate picture we have today of the growth of the continental land masses, but this is what it looks like. Where the plate tectonics doesn't do much at all until the beginning of what's called the Great Oxygenation Event. And this is a reference to the fact that the atmosphere of the Earth had way less than 1% oxygen, and then beginning 2.45 billion years ago, it went from 0.001% oxygen in the atmosphere up to 1 or 2%. That's called the first great oxygenation event. And what these researchers were able to demonstrate, that's what really caused the growth of the continental land masses to explode. And so you've got a picture here that's really very in sync with what you see in creation day 3. How in creation day 3, we see the continents appearing on the face of the Earth. And literally 90% of the continental landmass growth happens during that great oxygenation event. So not much until then. Then the sudden burst where it goes from 2% to 27% of the surface area of the Earth. And since that time, it's gradually increased from 27% to 29%. If you want to read about this and see the documentation in the scientific literature, and incidentally, a principle in science today is every research paper you can access for free on the web. The abstract is always available for free, and often they give you the whole paper for free. So take advantage of that. And I always do that in the articles that I publish, give you the links so that you can go straight to the papers yourself. But I put out a weekly blog called Today's New Reason to Believe, and the June 11th one that's posted at reasons.org talks about this discovery that was made last March. But basically, embodies the principle, the more we learn about science, the more we learn about nature, the stronger case we get for the complete scientific accuracy, everything the Bible declares. But notice on creation day 3, God's not done. Now that we've got continents here, he says, let the land produce vegetation. And he uses a Hebrew word for vegetation, desheh, which refers to green plant material, photosynthetic life. And then it gives you three examples. Basically talks about in the English how it's fruit, trees, and seeds. And we need to look at that as three of many examples that the text could have given us here. And incidentally, the Hebrew words for fruit, trees, and seeds are way more generic than they are in English. Not surprising because of the small vocabulary we have in biblical Hebrew. But in a couple of the debates I had with the Michael Shermer, the executive director of the Skeptic Society, says, this is a clear-cut case where Genesis got it dead wrong. Because in the fossil record, we see fossils of animals appearing before fossils of plants. But the Bible says plants first and animals second. And I remember responding to Michael and saying, well, that's not at all surprising. Animals have bones and shells, which are going to be easily preserved for hundreds of millions of years. That's not the case with animals. After a few hundred millions of years, their tissue will decay to a point where you're not going to have any fossil evidence. But what happened in 2009 is a paper was published in Nature basically saying we don't have the fossil evidence for plants on the continental land masses predating the animals in the oceans, but we do have isotope evidence. You know, things like the fact that plants prefer carbon-12 to carbon-13 and nitrogen-14 to nitrogen-15. They were able to use that to isotope evidence to conclude that vegetation was just as abundant on the continents for 200 million years before the first appearance of animals as the 200 million years thereafter. And in 2011, another paper got published in Nature where they said we've now found the fossils of these early plants, this early vegetation on the continental land masses. Now, there's a caveat. They didn't find complete fossils. They found fossil parts. The biggest part they found was 1 millimeter in diameter. So we're not like they're finding it. But that's not surprising. Given how easily plant tissue decays, that's about the biggest part you'd expect to find. But it was such that they were able to conclude that vegetation was abundant on the continents for 600 million years before the first appearance of the animals. So Genesis indeed got the order right. And then creation day 4, it says, let there be the great lights. So creation day 1, let there be light. This is the first time light appears on the surface of the waters. When it says in creation day 4, let there be the great lights, it follows up with this. Let there be the great lights so that they may serve as signs to mark seasons, days, and years. And if you go to creation day 5, it's talking about God creating the first animals. These are creatures that need to see where the sun, moon, and stars are in the sky in order to regulate their biological clocks. All animals need to have access to information about the position of the sun, moon, and stars in the sky. The plants don't need that, the bacteria don't need that, but the animals do. Now, what we do know is that just before the appearance of the first animals, what we call the second great oxygenation event. And so this is what the history of oxygen in the atmosphere looks like. And you say, how do they determine this? They determine this from isotope measurements in the crust of the Earth. That gives them a good proxy for how much oxygen was in the atmosphere. And there you can see in this graph the first great oxygenation event, where for about a 200 million year period, the oxygen content jumps up to about 1 or 2%, but then it falls back down to about 1% and stays at that 1% level until about 578 million years ago. And then it suddenly jumps up from 1% to 8%. They call that the second great oxygenation event, stimulated by what you may have heard about in your geology classes, the great unconformity. That was a tremendous dumping of material in the oceans, caused a chemical transformation, and resulted in this sudden jump in oxygen. Now, that explains what we see in creation day 5. Animals need a lot of oxygen in the atmosphere in order for them to be able to function. And so until the oxygen got to 8%, there is no possibility of animal life. It explains why we see nothing but microbes on the face of the Earth until the second great oxygenation event. But what happened a few months ago is a group of physicists did an experiment. Basically, they took the atmosphere of planet Earth as it was determined by these isotope measurements at different points throughout Earth's history. And then they threw in the requisite oxygen amount in order to simulate what we see here in this graph. And what they discovered is, with the oxygen content below 1%, Earth's atmosphere becomes so hazy that it's impossible for creatures on the face of the Earth to see the objects responsible for the light. The haze is just too thick. And so as they increase the oxygen content, they discovered that you get an atmosphere that's progressively less and less hazy. And what I'm going to show you here is basically what they found in their lab experiment. And I'm going to do this with a photograph of Engineer Peak that I took in Colorado. And so this first photo you see here, and you know, I'm sitting about a little less than a mile from the summit of Engineer Peak, about half a mile from the summit. And here you can barely make out that there's a mountain there because of how thick the haze is. And actually at 1%, it'd be even hazier than this. You wouldn't be able to see the mountain at all from a half mile away. But I did this just for a visual effect here. And so as you increase the oxygen content, what you notice is the mountain becomes more and more clearly visible. As the oxygen content rises from 1% up to 8%. And if you look to the upper right, you begin to see an object in the sky. There it is, the moon. And in the first photo, you couldn't see the moon at all, couldn't see the sun, couldn't see any stars. But what this lab experiment demonstrated that indeed, what we see in Genesis chapter 1 is correct, that it's impossible to see the sun, moon, and stars until the fourth day when you get this second great oxygenation event, and then suddenly, for the first time, it's possible for creatures on the surface of the Earth to see the sun, moon, and stars. If you want to read about this, it's in my June 18th blog article, Today's New Reason to Believe. Incidentally, I write them all for a lay audience. They're about 1,000 words roughly each, and I bring one out every Monday. Tomorrow, I'll be bringing out one that you can read, making the point that, hey, in the scientific literature, literally on a daily basis, there's research papers being published that give us a stronger case for the message of what the Bible declares. But this is what the oxygen history of the Earth really looks like over time. And so when it jumps up to 8% for the first time, you got conditions that make life possible. And this is what you see in the fossil record. You go from nothing but microbes to animals that are as big as 2 meters across. But at 8% oxygen, we got animals without a heart, without a brain, without a digestive tract. There's simply not enough oxygen for animals to have those internal organs. That requires a minimum of 10% oxygen. But what you can see from the graph here, we go from 8% to 10% very suddenly. So the first appearance of animals, what we call the Avalon explosion, animals without these complex internal organs. But 543 million years ago, we get what's called the Cambrian explosion, where animals with hearts and brains and digestive tracts, eyes, ears, begin to appear. And what does the text say on creation day five? Let the waters teem with living creatures. And indeed, we call it the Cambrian explosion because suddenly the oceans are just filled with all these diversity of animals. And literally every phylum you can think of shows up at the beginning of the Cambrian explosion. When this was first published 60 years ago, people were claiming, well, okay, we don't get all the complex animals. The vertebrates must come 50 million years later. But now they found in China a parallel site to the sites in Canada where they find that vertebrates indeed are right there at the very beginning of the Cambrian explosion. Moreover, the beginning of the Cambrian explosion, we see every complex eye design that exists today. It happens all at once. This is what Richard Dawkins, probably today's most famous atheist scientist, a British evolutionary biologist, he wrote this a number of years ago in reference to the Cambrian explosion. He says, the Cambrian strata of rocks, vintage about 600 million years ago, are the oldest ones in which we find most of the major invertebrate groups. We also find the vertebrates. And we find many of them already in an advanced state of evolution the first time they appear. It is as though they were just planted there without any evolutionary history. And indeed, he's right. They just show up immediately. There's no time delay. Or this is what Gregory Ray said in the journal American Zoologist. The Cambrian explosion of body plans is perhaps the single most striking feature of the Metazoan fossil record. The rapidity with which phyla and classes appeared during the early Paleozoic, coupled with much lower rates of appearance, poses an outstanding problem for macroevolution. What he meant there is an outstanding problem for naturalistic macroevolution. And Kevin Peterson, in a long review in Bioessays, one of the world's experts on the Cambrian explosion, said, quote, elucidating the materialistic basis for the Cambrian explosion has become more elusive, not less, the more we know about the event itself. And even James Valentine recently published a book, still an atheist, where he says, there's no way we're going to get phyla through any naturalistic evolutionary process. You can read about this in more detail in my book, Improbable Planet. And yes, we're giving away a free chapter at reasons.org/Ross. Creation Day 5 is the second time you see the word bara translated to create, referring to God creating something brand new that never existed before. And Dave Sargent spoke on this while I was in Vancouver, British Columbia, how God creates three different kinds of life. Life that's purely physical, Creation Day 1, Creation Day 5. Life that's physical and soulish, a reference to birds and mammals. These are the creatures that God designed to relate and serve and please a higher species of life, namely us human beings. And then last of all, he creates us human beings that are body, soul, and spirit. But then he talks on Creation Day 6 about creating three kinds of advanced land mammals. Now to be clear here, Genesis 1 does not describe God creating the first land mammals. That's omitted. You only get the highlights in Genesis 1. You get a lot more detail on this, as I mentioned, in Job 37, 38, and 39. So it jumps ahead to God creating three specialized subcategories of land mammals, the rodents, which were critical for enabling humans to move from a hot climate zone into a cold climate zone. And today, they proved to be very valuable for medical advance. It's amazing how God designed these rodents with a DNA that's very similar to human DNA, particularly with respect to brain chemistry and the digestive tract. So if you're ever having a digestive disorder, you might want to thank God for these rodents. And then there's two different kinds of long-legged land mammals. Those that are easy to tame, a reference to the herbivores we use for sustaining our agricultural industry. And then we have the long-legged land mammals that are difficult to tame, a reference to the carnivores that make excellent household companions and pets. And you can read about this. And you know, believe it or not, the lion makes an incredibly good pet. Difficult to tame, but once tamed, makes an outstanding pet. In fact, when I was on the faculty at Caltech, there was a student who would bring his pet lion to class every day. And that pet lion loved going to class because that lion would actually run down and sit at the foot of the professor because that way you got 200 students watching him. So just loved to be. And loved to have the children romp with her during lunch hour. Anyway, you can read about these amazing animals in my book, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job. Again, we're giving away a free chapter at reasons.org/Ross. But last of all, God creates human beings. And this is only the third time it uses the word create. And just as God created the birds and mammals to relate to a higher species and serve and please a higher species, he designed us with a spirit so we can relate to a higher being and serve and please that higher being. And in that sense, I think it's, we need to have contact with these birds and mammals. God designed them to teach us important spiritual lessons. And I describe those lessons in Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job. But we've got this book, Who is Adam?, where we lay out the latest scientific evidence that indeed the Bible got it right, that the entire human species is descended from two individuals, Adam and Eve, that God created a few tens of thousands of years ago. But here's the bottom line. With this advancing science, understanding that this word yom refers to an epoch of time, that the reference frame is the surface of the earth, the science accuracy score we get for the creation events, in terms of their order and their detailed descriptions, the Bible gets a perfect score. Now, when I was reading Genesis at age 17, I was contrasting it with the other creation texts and the other holy books and the other creation stories. The best I found outside of the Bible was the Enuma Elish, which gets 2 of 14 right. Outside of the Bible is the only one that doesn't get a score of 0. So the fact that it got 2 right is pretty amazing. And most people think it got 2 right because of the proximity of the Babylonians with the Hebrews, who were being inspired by God to give the perfect score here. But the fact that we get 10 for 10 tells me this is evidence that the Bible indeed had to be inspired by the one that created the universe. How else do you explain that it was actually predicting scientific discoveries thousands of years ahead of its time and never once having an error? And you can read about this in more detail in this book, Navigating Genesis. And actually, several of you that are here have been using our small group DVD teaching series to take groups through this in a discussion-oriented environment. But the bottom line is, the more we learn about science, the more reasons we gain to believe that the Bible is God's word, inspired without error, without exceptions. And that's what we're committed to do for you at Reasons to Believe, is show you that advancing science is progressively giving us a stronger and stronger case, literally on a daily basis. With that, I'll take questions, and I'll take questions on any topic. It doesn't have to be today's topic or the topic of the last few weeks. It can be anything. And by the way, we're also live streaming, so we'll be taking questions from the live stream audience as well. I think last week we had 115 that were participating through live streaming, so you're not alone here. And by the way, we do have one rule. One question per person per turn. If you got four questions, please take four separate turns. And yes, we'd like to get you on the microphone. So if you got a question, yes, we'll bring a microphone to you.
Yeah, it's good we have the microphone because I watched on streaming last week and I couldn't hear the questions.
But well, anyway, we can hear you.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Sure.
Okay. Earlier you mentioned that there were clouds that obscured the light in the early days of the earth. Was there rain during that time? Because I remember years ago, a pastor told me rain started when the flood started. That's probably because he believed in the canopy effect. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. If you want the detailed answer, you'll find it in Navigating Genesis. But yeah, there's people who have read the later chapters of Genesis and have drawn the conclusion it didn't rain until after the flood. The error there is that it does talk in Genesis 2 about God watering the Garden of Eden with a mist. But that's the Garden of Eden. It's a locale. And I believe the Garden of Eden is located in what is now the southeast portion of the Persian Gulf. During the last ice age, the sea level was 400 feet lower than it is today. That would have been dry land. And that part of the Persian Gulf area, you don't get rain like we got today and yesterday. You get this fine mist. And the Hebrew word there basically is distinguishing mist from rain. The two words are ed and matar. One of those words means relatively large drops of liquid water coming down from the sky. The other word means little tiny drops of water coming down from the sky. Technically, they're both rain. One is small drops and one is big drops. I grew up in coastal British Columbia. If the raindrops were less than 3/16 of an inch in diameter, we called it a mist. Here you call that a heavy rainstorm. So it all depends where you live. And again, given the context of the Garden of Eden, we can understand the choice of the two different words. But yes, it was raining before the flood, just as it was raining after the flood. When God told Noah about the rainbow, he was quite familiar with rainbows. He had seen them before. And incidentally, God always does that when he signs a covenant. He always takes something from the natural realm that we're familiar with and uses that as a symbol that he's going to keep the commitment that he's making to us. So in that context, that again is evidence that there had to be rain before the flood. But yeah, Genesis 1, the second creation day, and Job 37:38 talk about the water cycle that God set up.
I noticed in the correlation between the development of continents and the oxygen development that the continents seem to have been triggered by the first oxygenation event.
Yes.
And has there been much study to at least theorize about what sort of chemical processes were going on with early life forms on both the continents and the dry land where it would have taken the oxygen back down for a time period? And how much chemical development would be going on of what sort in order to end up at 600 million years ago when the life processes and the chemical environment enabled a spike of animals?
Well, when you read the paper that I was referring to about that sudden growth of the continents, you actually got plate tectonic activity happening before, but it's not enough to get the continents above sea level. In fact, when you look at the paper, it basically shows you a map of the world with these underwater land masses that are a couple of hundred feet below the water. The first great oxygenation event basically punches up those underwater land things above sea level very suddenly and very quickly. And so you don't need a lot of tectonic plate movement to get, say, 500 feet of uplift. And that explains how you go from less than 2% to 27% very quickly. But once those continents are in place, oxygenation beyond that doesn't have much effect in building up the continents. It's got some. So you do get a slow growth of continents thereafter. And now we've got a rather detailed knowledge of the oxygen in Earth's atmosphere. The only place where we have some uncertainty is where I had that dotted line in the graph. And so there is evidence that the oxygen may have been going up and down a little bit from, say, 1% down to close to zero, back up to 1%, close to zero. And that would have affected the ecology that was going on in the oceans. Because after all, there are certain microbes that really need that 1%. And when it's not that high, they would have gone extinct, but then they come back. Now, is there more to your question than that?
No.
That's it? Okay. We got an online question.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, actually, we've got quite a few online questions. The first question is from Lucas E. The question for you is, with the Chang'e moon missions in mind, do we have an update concerning early fossilization?
Could you repeat that word? What fossil event is he talking about? Is he referring to the Chinese? I mean, what's the spelling? C-H-E-N?
Yes, C-H-A-N-G and then apostrophe E.
Yeah, I think he's referring to discovery in China. There's a desert in southern China where they have found a very significant fossil bed of Cambrian explosion creatures. I mean, we really got this whole discipline going as they discovered Cambrian fossils in the Canadian Rockies in several different sites. But it was basically looking at animals in the middle part of the Cambrian explosion. This Chinese fossil bed actually gives us an outstanding view of the very beginning of the Cambrian event. And what they discovered is all the animals that you see in the Canadian fossils, you also see at the very beginning. In the Chinese spine, because there was speculation going on, well, maybe there was a 40 or 50 million period of evolution going on. The Chinese fossil beds actually refute that, because what you see is you have these animals in just as complex forms at the beginning of the Cambrian explosion as you do in the middle of the Cambrian explosion. And now they've actually found quite a few sites around the world with these Cambrian animals in it, but it's basically making a point, yes, we are justified in calling an explosion because all these animals and all their great diversity show up all at once. At the very moment, oxygen goes from 1% up to 8%. There's no time delay, or pardon me, from 8% to 10%. Okay, you got another question from the online people? No, we got one right here. Go ahead.
Dr. Ross, regarding the creation of man, an evolutionary description in some form, I hear that there's a Neanderthal DNA in the human species. So can you describe that?
Yeah, you'll see quite a bit about this in the second edition of Who is Adam? We cover that subject. But what he's referring to is this debate going on today about whether or not humans that were migrating into Europe had contact with Neanderthals and interbred with Neanderthals. And it's based on a study that indicates that Europeans and Asians and Pacific Islanders have more similarity with Neanderthal DNA than sub-Saharan Africans. Now, I've read the paper. There's 11 authors on the paper, and those 11 authors represent Asians, Europeans, and Pacific Islanders, but there are no sub-Saharan Africans amongst those 11 anthropologists. So when this paper was published a few years ago, I said, before we give any credence to this idea that humans interbred with Neanderthals, this needs to be repeated, where we use sub-Saharan African geneticists and anthropologists to work with a new specimen of Neanderthal DNA and see if we get the same result. Because as they said in the paper, we were very careful to avoid contamination, but we can't guarantee that our DNA influences the results that we got. Moreover, as I read the paper, the signal they got for interbreeding was very weak. It was basically 3.5 times the noise, which in the hard sciences, physics and chemistry and astronomy, would not have been published. We demand 5 times a greater signal than the noise. So it's a very weak signal. Moreover, it doesn't show up in the mitochondrial DNA. It only shows up in the Y chromosome DNA. And as the researchers pointed out, this means if interbreeding did take place, it was at a very low level. In fact, they concluded their paper, this would be evidence that humans living 40,000 years ago were practicing bestiality at a level far less than people do today. And so, and bottom line is, we've written, even if this is a real signal, it does not impact the image of God. And so the fact that we only see it in the Y chromosome and not the mitochondrial DNA, again, tells us that probably if there were children born from this, their fertility was either very limited and therefore would not have propagated. However, one of our scholars is a woman who just got her PhD a few years ago in physical anthropology. She's an expert on this, and we've had her at our office, Sue Dykes, and she basically is making the point, we need to be careful not to give this credence. There's a lot of other explanations for the DNA similarity we see here. They're assuming that the shared DNA we have in Neanderthals is defective DNA, but we could be overlooking the purpose. And so, for example, there might be a very good reason why European humans would have more DNA similarity with Neanderthals, because guess what? Where did they live? They lived in Europe and in Western Siberia, and their climatic conditions there would affect the DNA. In fact, my colleague Faisal Rana has written how you can explain racial diversity in as little as four generations if you move from the tropics up to the high latitudes. And so this is still an open question. A lot of people think that this is a done deal. It's far from a done deal. There may not be any interbreeding at all. And if there is interbreeding, it's at a very low level that has no impact on the DNA. And by the way, I would expect that Satan, for example, would love to mess up the DNA of humans, and this would be a good way to do it. So maybe he's the guy we need to finger.
Here we've got another online question from Sarah B. It's in regards to the creation of life. RTB has said God intervened billions of times in the creation of new species. This sounds similar to theistic evolution. What makes the difference? I struggle with the various kind of contradicting definitions of theistic evolution being completely random or being guided by God.
Okay, very good question. How do we distinguish the reasons to believe model on the origin and history of life from what you get from theistic evolutionists and a new group that refers to themselves as evolutionary creationists? If you want a detailed answer, we did a Four Views book. It's called Four Views on Creation, Evolution, and Intelligent Design, where I, as the president of Reasons to Believe, debated my position relative to Deborah Harzma, the president of BioLogos, which is promoting evolutionary creationism, Ken Ham, promoting young earth creationism, and Steve Meyer of the Discovery Institute. We also make available a book, which is a Two Views book, which is a book showing the Reasons to Believe position and the BioLogos position, which is basically the evolutionary creation position. And what you'll see, particularly in the Two Views book, but also in the Four Views book, is the big distinction is this. They believe that God used natural process and directed the history of life on planet Earth. But as we challenge them, okay, well, exactly how does God direct? He says, well, we believe that God does it supernaturally, but in a way that no scientist can ever discern. And I said, well, that means your model is identical to the atheistic model. There's really no difference. So how can you challenge them? And that's kind of where we're different. We're saying, yes, God did directly intervene, but directly intervenes that we can scientifically establish and use that as a way to challenge those people who believe that God wasn't involved at all. And in particular, we thought we could get some common ground with our friends of BioLogos on the origin of life. Because there's a surety there you believe in supernatural intervention. And we discovered that they think that's possible, but they're not willing to take a stand on it. Whereas we clearly do, as you'll see in my talk next week, how I think the science has advanced to the point that we can confidently say this is not a naturalistic event. It must be supernatural based on the science alone. And next week I'll actually be citing from some of the world's leading origin of life researchers who are basically making the same points we are. And incidentally, the book we wrote over there in the Origins of Life, it got reviewed by one of the world's leading atheistic origin of life researchers, David Deamer. You can read his review in the journal Origin of Life and Evolution of the Biosphere. Bottom line is, he says, I really like the science in this book. It's the most comprehensive, multidisciplinary treatment on the origin of life. I like everything except the Jesus Christ part. So, but that'll be next week's talk. But that was kind of where we were going with our friends saying, look, surely here we got some common ground. But what I'm discovering is true of theistic evolutionists and evolutionary creationists. They want a model of creation that 95%+ of the scientific community will agree with. Well, as I've shared with my friends of BioLogos, the Bible is quite clear it will not be a majority. The Bible is clear that the majority of humanity, in spite of the evidence, will refuse to give God the credit. But it would be a big minority. My problem with the young Earth people that we're engaging is that they seem quite comfortable if they got 0.01% secular science support. And I think from the Bible's perspective, you're going to get a whole lot more than that. It's going to be a big minority. So the fact that we have 30 to 40% secular science support, I think is right in line with what the Bible tells us that we should expect. And if you got that much support, you definitely have scientific credibility. In fact, I can you can get an online debate I did with Paul Davies. It's audio only, but what he said is, given that you guys at Reasons to Believe have a testable model that's distinct from what we atheists and agnostics are putting out, you have a place at the scientific table because we have a model. And incidentally, I want to share that with you. If you want to change scientists' minds about evolution, you have to give them an alternative that explains the scientific data in a better way than the model they have. The way science operates, they stick to their models, no matter how many flaws are in their models, until a better model comes forward to replace their model. You can't simply just critique their model. You have to contrast it with an alternative model. So I think that's the biggest difference. We actually have a specific alternative model. Okay, who's next? Right here.
These things, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
You mentioned that the DNA of the the species now, not the ones in Europe. You said the DNA is very similar to ours. Now, is it possible that we can breed with them right now?
Okay. No, it's not possible for humans to breed with any other species and to get offspring, because the DNA is too different. That can't happen. But yeah, people have been speculating that maybe the DNA of Neanderthals is close enough that it's a possibility. Keep in mind, with the Neanderthal genome, it's only two-thirds complete. So it's still an open question whether or not it's possible. But frankly, a lot of us at Reasons to Believe have doubt that you could get offspring from Neanderthal and human interbreeding. And by the way, the opportunity for the interbreeding was very slight. There's almost no overlap time between humans going into Europe and the extinction of the Neanderthals in Europe. So it's quite possible they never really met one another, in which case that would call into question any interbreeding that did take place. But let me say this. There's a lot of DNA similarity amongst all the species of life here on planet Earth. Your DNA, for example, is 26% identical to daffodil DNA. It's 95% identical to chimpanzee DNA. And this actually works to our advantage. Because God uses a common design template in the DNA, it's possible that we can take advantage of other creatures on the face of the earth to build our medical advance. And so the reason why we're living longer today and living a higher quality of life is largely due to the fact that we have DNA that's so similar to the DNA of animals around us. The reason why they do medical experiments in mice and rats. In many respects, their internal organs are structured like ours, their DNA is like ours, and the big advantage is they have a rapid reproduction time. So every 3 months you get a new generation, which you can do more experiments on. Whereas if you're working with chimpanzees, you've got to wait a long time to get another generation. Not so with mice and rats. And mice and rats like hanging around humans, and you can do experiments on tens of thousands of them. So they really are an ideal lab animal for doing medical research. And yeah, what's amazing is their digestive tract and their brain chemistry is identical to that of humans. And so, a matter of fact, there are some really big breakthroughs coming through right now using mice and rats to develop therapy and cures for dyslexia, dementia, and Alzheimer's, mainly because, unlike the chimpanzees, their brain chemistry is very close to our brain chemistry. So, question here, yeah.
Last week you were talking about dark energy, and this week I was reading up on plasmas a little bit. My question is, one, are they related? And two, is this kind of the frontier of research right now?
Okay. There's been a resurgence in what's called the plasma model for cosmology. It was proposed, like 70 years ago. Then it went away, and then it came back through the writings of Eric Lerner. And then it went away, and now it seems to be coming back again. And it's this idea that cosmology needs to take into account not just the gravitational aspect of the universe, but the electromagnetic. And so it's basically proposing that the electromagnetism has a major factor in the dynamics and the history of the universe. And these plasma people are right. I mean, when we astronomers build our cosmological models, we're assuming that gravity is the dominant factor to consider, unless we're talking the extremely early moment of the universe, in which case we bring into take into account quantum effects as well, but not electromagnetic. And the reason why is that the electromagnetic fields we measure in the universe are so very weak. But there's speculation going on that maybe they're not as weak as what we say. And you'll find a couple of articles I've written at reasons.org. Again, go to today's new Reason to Believe. Probably the biggest refutation of these plasma models are what we call intergalactic magnetic fields. So there's speculation that maybe these fields between galaxies were strong enough that electromagnetic effects could change the way. And incidentally, kind of the prime motive amongst these plasma models is to challenge Big Bang cosmology and to challenge the idea that there's an actual beginning to the universe. However, the measurements we have in these intergalactic magnetic fields basically rule out any possibility of a plasma model for the universe. Not that the plasma isn't important, but it's not going to impact your cosmological models. Okay, running out of time. We'll take one more question.
Yes. Do scientists have an idea of what started the oxygenation that you mentioned in today's lecture?
Yes, they do have an idea. The second great oxygenation event they feel is tied into what's called the Great Unconformity. Again, if you study geology, you'll notice that there's a lot of features on the face of the Earth where they show that there's been a major geological disturbance that goes back to about 578 million years ago. And it coincides with the second great oxygenation event. What is a great unconformity? Some major tectonic disturbance that caused massive landslides of continental mass land material into the oceans. So the oceans got a very sudden, massive input of continental land mass material. It altered the chemistry of the oceans and basically fostered this growth of phytoplankton, which pumped all this oxygen in the atmosphere. I mean, in terms of oxygen, the phytoplankton are quite capable of oxygenating our atmosphere very quickly. The reason that doesn't happen is we have stuff in the crust of the Earth and the mantle of the Earth that basically sucks up the oxygen. We basically got minerals that rust. And so, I mean, if you leave iron out, you notice it'll rust. And so that saps oxygen. So we refer to these things called oxygen sinks. But where you get these major jumps in oxygen in the atmosphere is when a major oxygen sink gets filled. When it gets filled, then these photosynthetic life forms quickly pump a lot of oxygen in the atmosphere. They can literally do it in thousands of years. But if you've got minerals that are sucking up the oxygen as fast as they make it, then there's no change in the oxygen content in the atmosphere. And so that's what happened 578 million years ago. A major oxygen sink got filled thanks to this great unconformity, and the photosynthetic life very quickly bumped up the oxygen content. Okay, that will close this out. We got another event happening in a few minutes. If you didn't get to ask your question, again, you can go to my Facebook and Twitter page. Next week, we'll do this again. And incidentally, everything here has gotten recorded. You can watch it later on YouTube or paradoxes.org. Thank you.